one more chapter in this unit, and that is photosynthesis. Slide one simply shows you some pictures of representative species that are capable of photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is a set of pathways that, from the viewpoint of the organism, produces not only food, but also raw material for producing other kinds of organic molecules. All right, now, only one ecological category of organisms is capable of doing this, and that's called a producer. All producers do the same thing, the same important thing, that no consumer is capable of doing. And that is to take carbon from an inorganic source, like CO2, for instance, and incorporate that carbon into organic compounds, which can then be either used as fuel or converted into other organic compounds, the ones that we've been studying all along. That process of incorporating carbon from an inorganic source into organic compounds has a special name. Did I already tell you this? What is that called? Maybe I haven't. It's called carbon fixation. So producers do the important thing of fixing carbon, putting the carbon into organic form. All of the consumers rely on producers for this reason, because all organisms, to remain alive, need organic compounds. That's what we've been talking about up to this point, in one way or another. Well, we consumers cannot use the carbon that's inorganic in inorganic form, like CO2 that's in the air around us, to do anything, to make any organic compounds. We have to take our organic compound, we have to take in our carbon already in organic form, which we can then turn into other organic molecules, but it has to be organic to start with for a consumer, not for a producer. A producer can make its own organic compounds out of inorganic carbon sources, and that's called carbon fixation. Most producers do this carbon fixation using energy that's in light, which is one form of carbon fixation. That's called photosynthesis. That's what we're studying in this chapter. There are some chemosynthetic organisms as well. They also fix carbon, but they do it not driven by the energy of light, but by driven by the energy of chemical potential energy. We're focusing on photosynthesis here. And usually when photosynthesis is mentioned, we automatically think of plants. They are major photosynthetic organisms, and they're all around us here on Earth. We tend to forget about the fact that most life is in the oceans. But they are major photosynthetic organisms, but they're eukaryotes, right? Which means they're relatively recent cells. Throughout most of the history of life, there were no eukaryotes. There were only prokaryotes originally, including bacteria. And bacteria invented photosynthesis long before there were any eukaryotic cells. So it's been around for a long time. Most of the history of photosynthesis, though, there were only prokaryotes doing this. I talked about the endosymbiotic theory, the fact that chloroplasts were created by endosymbiosis. A eukaryotic cell engulfed a photosynthetic bacterium, and it survived the process and became the first chloroplast. That explains why some, but not all, eukaryotes are photosynthetic. Well, the photosynthetic eukaryotes include plants, of course. They have chloroplasts. But they're not the only eukaryotes. There are also some protists that are eukaryotic. Do you remember what I mean by protist? What does protist mean? It's a protist is any eukaryotic organism that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Animals and fungi are consumers. We have to eat. We can't make our own food. Plants, of course, are photosynthetic. But if you're not an animal, plant, or a fungus, and you are a eukaryote, then you are some sort of protist. Not all protists are photosynthetic, but some are. And if you are a protist that is photosynthetic, then you are categorized as an alga, the plural of which is algae. So not only plants are photosynthetic within eukarya, so are algae. And there are tiny algae, single-celled, and there are enormous algae the size of trees. Brown algae can be huge, for instance. This just gives you several different eukaryotic photosynthesizers, plus also prokaryotic. The ones that got it started to begin with are the bacteria that invented the process. Now, of course, prokaryotes do not have membrane-bounded organelles by definition. So the original photosynthesis that they invented occurs within a non-compartmentalized cell. They have only one membrane. But their membrane is highly folded. So it does the same stuff that's happening within a chloroplast of a plant or an alga, which is what we're going to study it as. They just don't have chloroplast, right? They became chloroplast when they were engulfed. The process is basically the same, though largely the same as far as what happens. So let's take a look at a plant in slide 2. In a typical plant, like a tree, the principal photosynthetic organs are the leaves. And you can tell that by looking at a typical plant because the leaves are the greenest part of the plant. That's not always true. As a matter of fact, we live right around a lot of exceptions to that. Cacti are plants. They are photosynthetic. But their leaves have been, through evolution, highly adapted for a different purpose. The leaves do not photosynthesize, and they're not green for that reason. They've evolved into spines as a defensive mechanism. Instead, the stem, the main body of a cactus, is the green part. Well, on any plant, whatever the green part is, that's where photosynthesis can take place. Some trees have leaves and trunks that are green. But in a typical plant, the leaves are where most of the photosynthesis is occurring. And a typical leaf is a flat structure that's arranged more or less like a sandwich. So the two slices of bread, in a sense, the top and bottom part of a leaf, are epithelial arrangements of cells. An epithelium is a lining. It's a tissue formed of cells that, for the purpose of lining something. So these are the outer linings in direct contact with the atmosphere. And that forms a pretty waterproof boundary. It's a good seal, basically. But it can't be a perfect seal, of course, because if it were a perfect seal, then no gas would be able to get into or out of the plant, including the gases that are involved in photosynthesis, carbon dioxide and water and oxygen. So this otherwise pretty good seal on each piece of bread is perforated. It's full of holes. Those holes are called stomata, which is a plural word. The singular is simply stoma, which means mouth, but means opening in this case. So a stoma is not an actual structure, it's just the space, but it's the space between two cells called guard cells that by changing their osmotic intake or release of water can open or close the stoma. So plants can adjust how much gas is allowed through those stomata. And CO2 and O2 are shown here because those are the two gases involved in photosynthesis. The plant has to take in CO2, that's the carbon source, to fix that carbon into an organic compound. And oxygen is a byproduct of that. The meat of the sandwich, so to speak, the part that's between the two slices of bread is mostly made up of what are called mesophyll cells. Phyll means plant, and meso means middle, so it's well named. It's the middle of the leaf. Actually, phyll means leaf. But anyway, the mesophyll cells are what make the leaf look green to us, and not really the entire cell. If you look at this cell, just an isolated mesophyll cell, and this is a real photomicrograph, you can see that the greenness is not the entire cell, it's really just the chloroplasts within the cell. A typical mesophyll cell in a leaf will contain about 50 chloroplasts. And each chloroplast contains millions of pigments, molecules of pigment called chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is what allows, or what makes the thing look green to us. All right, now let's review, because we've seen this before, the basic anatomy of one chloroplast. Just like a mitochondrion, it is multiply membrane bounded because it came into being by endosymbiosis. That added a layer to it. So there is an outer membrane and an inner membrane, but there's a third membrane that we name in a chloroplast, even though technically it's really just an elaboration or an extension of the inner membrane. The inner membrane here and there will fold inward and become all of this green stuff in the picture. That collectively is called thylakoid membrane. So the thylakoid membrane is continuous with the inner membrane in the same way that the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is continuous with the outer nuclear membrane. Okay? But because of all this folding in the way that it happens, it makes these round sacs. Each of those sacs is called a thylakoid, and when we look at the cutaway view, we can see that they're not separate from each other. Each thylakoid has an interior, but it is continuous with the interior of the next thylakoid. So there is overall one big compartment made up of the interiors of all of these thylakoids, and that's called the thylakoid space. All right? The thylakoids are arranged in stacks. Each stack is called a granum, the singular, the plural of which is grana, and there are several grana within one chloroplast. But because there are these multiple membranes, there are correspondingly multiple compartments within a chloroplast, just like for a mitochondrion. So there is an intermembrane space between outer and inner membranes. That's one fluid. There is the fluid that's inside the inner membrane but outside of the thylakoids, and that is called the stroma, which you should be careful with because it has nothing to do with stoma, but word-wise it's almost the same word. The R matters here. Stroma is its own fluid, different from the intermembrane space. And then there's still a third fluid that's different, and that's inside the thylakoids, and that stuff, as I said before, is called the thylakoid space. Okay, that's where photosynthesis happens in a eukaryote. Now, on slide 3, we're looking at inputs and outputs, reactants and products. So, remember in the previous chapter that I said that you can summarize the complete oxidation of glucose with a chemical reaction, which is called a summary reaction. It's only a summary because in cells, it doesn't happen in one shot, right? It's many reactions. It's a series of pathways, but you have a starting set of molecules and you have an ending set of molecules. You have reactants and you have products. And therefore, even though you're skipping the details, you can pretend that it's happening in one shot to summarize the overall process. And what was the For the complete oxidation of glucose, what was the summary reaction? What do you have to start with? Glucose, which is a hexose, so C6H12O6. What else? oxygen. Well, we're not counting those because they are not, because those are reused within the cell. So you have to supply the fuel, which is glucose. You have to supply oxygen. And what are the outputs? Water. And what else? Carbon dioxide, completely spent fuel. And to balance it, you'd have to have six O2s, six waters, and six carbon dioxides. And, those are the materials. Also, there is energy as an output, right, in the form of ATP that's produced. Okay, well, remember the reciprocal relationship between the complete oxidation of glucose and photosynthesis, which is what we're looking at here. That means they undo each other, which means they have exactly opposite summary reactions. Now, importantly, photosynthesis isn't simply the complete oxidation of glucose run in reverse. But when you look at what you start with and end with in photosynthesis, it's exactly the reverse of what you start with and end with the complete oxidation of glucose. So if you wanted to write the summary reaction for photosynthesis, it would be this same thing in reverse. You start with energy in the form of sunlight, and you start with two materials, inorganic carbon source, which is CO2, and water, and you end up with organic compounds, sugar, and oxygen. Okay, so this slide 3 shows you this, except it lists water as both a reactant and a product, which it is. But notice that you have to put 12 waters in and you get 6 out. Therefore, just to simplify the reaction, you would subtract 6 from both sides. And that's why, in my summary, there's six waters only on one side, none on the other. Okay? But the summary reactions for these two reciprocal processes are exactly opposite, even though they take totally different paths to get from start to end. But what complete oxidation of glucose spits out is exactly what photosynthesis takes in, and what photosynthesis spits out is exactly what the complete oxidation of glucose takes in. And never lose sight of the fact that a plant can do both of these. A plant has chloroplast for photosynthesis, and it has mitochondria, so it can also undergo glycolysis and cellular respiration. It's undergoing photosynthesis not to feed us. It's feeding itself. But we eat it, and therefore take advantage of the fact that we can exist without undergoing carbon fixation on our own. Okay, now to 4. This is a summary slide that looks similar to the summary slide we started with in the previous chapter, except that in the previous chapter, the overall process was occurring in two different places, right? The glycolysis occurred in the cytosol, and cellular respiration occurred in a mitochondrion. Well, in photosynthesis for a eukaryotic organism, which like a plant, photosynthesis occurs entirely within the chloroplast. There is no cytosolic part up to it. It's all within the chloroplast, which is this bean-shaped thing. And overall, the process of photosynthesis has two major components to it, which you can see in kind of like columns here. They've been called different things at different points in history. This book calls them the light reactions and the Calvin cycle. Those are the two parts. Those aren't particularly good names, though. In the old days, so you'd have to actually go to a textbook that's no longer used to look this up, but they originally called the light reactions and the dark reactions. And the dark reactions is not a very good name because it implies that darkness is required when it's not. So a while back, before you were born, they changed the names to much better terms, which are the light-dependent reactions, which explicitly says that light is required for that part, and the light-independent reactions. But the light-independent reactions is almost entirely made up of a cyclic pathway that can also be called the Calvin cycle, in honor of Calvin, of course. So the name Calvin cycle doesn't really tell you anything about it, but you're likely to see that. You can use that interchangeably with light-independent reactions. Let's talk about goals just like we did before with the other process. The goal here of photosynthesis is to produce organic compounds, which are versatile things, right? All organisms use organic compounds for all kinds of things, not just for fuel, but that includes fuel. So that's why I say that photosynthesizers feed themselves. One of the reasons that they're going to produce the sugars that photosynthesis produces is to use those sugars as fuel, just like we use fuel, the sugar from food that we eat, as fuel. But that's only one importance. The importance, as I said, is that carbon gets fixed. It's the carbon in inorganic carbon source gets turned into an organic compound. If you don't use it as fuel, you can turn it into any of the other organic compounds that the organism is capable of working, of making. So you can turn, you know, the next moment, if you don't use this as fuel, the organic compounds that photosynthesis produces can be converted into amino acids or any of the other things that we've been talking about. We do the same thing, but we have to take in an already organic compound. We can then mess with it and turn it into other organic compounds. Plants don't have to do that. So we can see that the goal, which is the production of organic compounds, is accomplished by the second part of photosynthesis, the light-independent reactions, or Calvin cycle. And we can see that that's happening in this second part because of the input and output. The input is CO2, which is carbon-containing but not organic, right? Organic doesn't simply mean containing carbon. Pure carbon is not organic, and neither is CO2. But the output after the Calvin cycle runs is sugar, which is organic. That, by definition, is carbon fixation, the thing that we consumers are incapable of doing. Well, think about this in terms of the energy chapter. When I gave you all those synonyms and antonyms, how would you describe the production of sugar from CO2 in terms of metabolism? What word would you use? Exactly. It's an anabolic process, photosynthesis, because it's building up a multi-carbon skeleton out of a single carbon reactant. Okay, so yes, that's the correct word in terms of metabolism. Well, what would you expect an anabolic process to be in terms of energy? Did you whisper something? It is not endergonic. I mean, yes, it is endergonic, meaning you have to supply energy, right? Which, notice, by the reciprocal relationship, it's exactly the opposite of what we do, right? We break down a sugar completely into CO2 to release energy. The plant is taking in energy to do the reverse, to incorporate the carbon from a simple molecule into a complex molecule. That's anabolic process, and it's endergonic. Well, it's also non-spontaneous, right? It's uphill endergonic things are never going to happen on their own. You have to force that to happen. And so this plant cell does, or specifically the chloroplast, does force that to happen. But what I mean by forcing an endergonic process to happen means to supply energy from outside of the system. We've talked about other examples of endergonic processes, like pumps, for instance, right? A pump is never going to work unless you give it an outside source of energy. That could be ATP or any other kind of energy, but it has to have some energy. Similarly for the Calvin cycle, since it's undergoing an anabolic set of reactions, you have to give it energy to do that. And it's not energy in any old form. It's specifically energy in two forms, and both have to be present. It's not either or, it's both. The Calvin cycle has to have energy in the form of specific reduced coenzymes, which is a different taxi company, very similar to the ones we talked about in the last chapter, but this one has a phosphate as part of the car. So it's NADP plus in its oxidized form on the empty taxi, and when it gets reduced, it's NADPH, NH plus. Other than the phosphate being there, it operates the same way as NAD does in cellular respiration. Anyway, though, you're used to thinking of reduced coenzymes as carrying energy. So this is one of the energy inputs that are required by the Calvin cycle. That's not enough, though. It also has to have energy specifically in the form of ATP. So that's why you see these energetic inputs, ATP and NADPH, entering the Calvin cycle. Of course, you also have to have the raw material that contains the carbon if you're going to make a carbon-containing compound. That's what CO2 is. That's the input of carbon, and it's inorganic. The output is not actually glucose directly. It's actually a 3-carbon compound called G3P. We'll look at that later. That is directly made by the Calvin cycle. But once a plant has this 3-carbon sugar, it can combine them into 6-carbon sugars, including glucose. It's just technically not still part of the Calvin cycle at that point. It's processed it later. All right, now, when the Calvin cycle uses these 2 required energy inputs, there's going to be lower energy outputs, right? When you spend ATP, you are dephosphorylating, and that's what the Calvin cycle does. So it turns it into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And when you spend the energy of a reduced coenzyme, you're emptying the passengers from the taxi, right? So the NADPH that supplies the Calvin cycle gets reoxidized into NADP+. Well, both of these lower energy forms then drive back to the first part of photosynthesis, which is the light-dependent reactions. They are required because there has to be an energetic intermediate, just like there is for cellular respiration, or more generally, the complete oxidation of glucose. I talked about this when I talked about the energy currency analogy, right? Just like people do not work directly for the things that they need, instead they work for money, and then money allows them to get the things that they need. Similarly, the Calvin cycle is not able to directly use energy from sunlight to fix carbon into sugar. Instead, it needs energy in these forms. Well, the energy comes from sunlight, but the light-dependent reactions are required first to capture the energy of sunlight in order to produce these energy-carrying molecules to supply the Calvin cycle. All right, is that enough for today?
Yeah.
Cool.